This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 68th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today John Steven.
Good afternoon.
Hi, John. John Steven is the internal CTO at Cigital. With over a decade of hands-on software security experience at the enterprise level, John's expertise ranges from threat modeling and architecture risk analysis through static analysis, with an emphasis on automation, to security testing. As a consultant to many multinational corporations, John provides strategic direction as a trusted advisor. John's keen interest in automation keeps Cigital services and technology at the cutting edge. John appears regularly at conferences and trade shows, leads the Northern Virginia OWASP chapter, and has served, like me, as the editor of the Building Security In department of IEEE S&P Magazine. John holds a BS in computer engineering and an MS in computer science from Case Western Reserve, and he lives in a newly purchased old house in Washington, D.C. with his fiance, Devin.
Yay.
So, question one. One of the major challenges facing software security involves shifting emphasis from an over-focus on finding problems to actually fixing problems. What are your customers saying about the hackneyed static versus dynamic, SaaS versus DaaS, hybrid bug-finding issue?
The good news is that the organizations I'm working with have gotten very good at finding bugs, as you begin to mention. And to some extent, they've actually over-specialized in a static or a dynamic or both techniques. And rather than having an effective strategy for combining the techniques to find bugs most effectively, they're often over-stovepiped in each. This has actually created problems for them in terms of their ability to fix the bugs. So, for instance, with their source code review or static findings, they're having trouble motivating the developers to fix the problems. They don't have exploits. And for the dynamic problems, they're having trouble finding the source of the problem or the place they'd prefer to fix it.
Gotcha. So that seems to suggest that hybrid would maybe help if it really worked.
Right, if it worked. The organizations that I have a lot of experience with are not bought into the hybrid tool set yet. In fact, going back to the over-specialization, it's sometimes difficult in these organizations to get the pen testers to talk to the code reviewers and vice versa. So they have organizational, cultural, structural problems to solve before those tools could even be put in place.
So how much of Cigital's work is focused on mitigating security problems, either through better architecture or better code, you know, as opposed to, say, penetration testing, finding problems, and not really fixing them?
So the preventative techniques, I think it's about a third. I'm not quite sure. And in terms of remediation, is that 10%, 25%? But, you know, those two things taken together, I'd say a good portion of the work we do.
So I guess that's important. One of the things that concerns me is that there are a lot of people that think about finding bugs all day and they never really worry about whether they get fixed. And it seems like we have to change the way we talk about this out there in the world so that we start fixing stuff.
Yeah, I think we see that, and we see it from a few different perspectives. The first is, now that people have mature static and dynamic scanning practices inside the organization, they're piling up more bugs than the business units and the product teams know what to do with. So some of that push to talk more about the fix is coming from the people they're piling the bugs on. Come on, guys, tell us what to do.
Or how to avoid this in the first place or whatever.
Right. You also see builder communities, or the builder label, growing up in classic pen testing or AppSec communities as well. And I think to some extent the over-specialization in a static or a dynamic technique or tool for finding bugs has prevented a lot of practitioners from being effective at showing people the fixes. They're not spending enough time looking at code. and understanding how to code.
So even if you are looking at code, do you think that there is any level of architecture analysis driving this quest to mitigate or eradicate problems, or is it mostly still being driven by bugs?
It's still very much being driven by bugs in my experience. And when you look at a lot of what the community resources out there provide, the closest to design or architecture help you get is this should be handled by a framework, which may or may not be true, but isn't necessarily useful architecture advice.
Look over there.
Yeah. So
speaking of architecture, at the BSIM conference recently, you noted that architecture is being pulled by financial services versus being pushed by tech firms. What does that mean?
Yeah, this is fascinating. So I've been speaking on threat modeling for too long probably, and publishing on threat modeling, and you know, I expected those little vignettes that were out there, you know, to prompt security groups to ask me, hey, is there some way we can incorporate that to find more or to find things earlier? And actually, yeah, you know, we're getting literally, you know, hand on arm drug into conversations with dev managers, architects, people who are building things for the financial firms, saying, look, the security guys keep piling up these bugs. We've asked them how to fix them, like, you know, we talked about. They don't have good answers for that necessarily. So can you teach me to do this threat modeling thing so I can find the things before they ever run their tool?
So there are classes of bugs that are somehow marshaled or rallied by architectural choices?
Well, I don't think these guys doing this pulling into things like threat modeling understand necessarily that there are, in fact, different classes of bugs. Uh-huh. And that's something you and I have talked a lot about on the net. And in the communities, but they do want to predict what is going to be found, and they do understand that there are very clever ways to prevent whole classes of bugs by doing something, not necessarily even introducing a security feature, mm-hmm. but just by structuring the way they build their code differently.
Okay, so I think I understand the pulled by financial services part, but I don't understand the pushed by tech firms part completely yet. So tell me what you meant by that. If you're contrasting, you know, architectural concerns being pulled by financial services versus pushed by tech firms.
Yeah. So, a lot of tech firms, you know, there are tech firms that build product or build platform, and typically they're one link in a supply chain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you look at someone who's building, you know, a mobile phone operating system or an app, there's a lot of other things that have to work for that to get to the consumer. And so what I'm finding is, whereas in the financials, you know, they're sick of the bug pile and they want to get in front of the bug pile and lessen it instead of playing whack-a-mole. So they're looking to reduce the effort the security guys are imposing on them. The ISVs are looking at it from a different perspective. They're saying, we know how to build software. We know how to build good product. We're starting to figure out how to build secure product. But the people we're buying software off of and the people we're supplying software to don't necessarily know how to build and deliver to us secure components or use our components securely. And so they're pushing their notions of threat modeling onto the other people in their ecosystem.
I see what you mean. Okay.
And so you know, they're asking their upstream suppliers to do things and think about security in ways that makes their software ultimately more secure. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about all the things, even, you know, Documentum, SiteMinder, all of these things. Some of them are security products. Some of them are just CMSs and other things. If you don't have a unified way of thinking about security and security architecture, then those pieces and parts will not collaborate to produce the security properties that you need.
Right. So, as you mentioned a minute ago, you've watched threat modeling and architecture risk analysis evolve and change for a decade. You know, I remember doing this stuff back in 97, 98, but yep. 2001, let's pretend that was the beginning. Then that's a decade. So why is ARA such a challenge? How much can we automate? And why is it so important that we work on it?
It's really important because, you know, people have spent millions, tens of millions of dollars on penetration testing, code review, and the tools associated with them yearly, in their organizations. And, you know, not only are they finding the same things year after year, but they're missing whole classes of things and whole classes of things that end up being bigger holes and more important risk than the things they're facing. So, you know, the reason, I think, is pretty evident to people.
So I would boil that down to bugs and flaws, 50-50.
Yes.
You know, work some on the flaws. Hello.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so why is it such a challenge?
And by the way, 10 years ago, in fact, I think 3 and 5 years ago, people were still arguing about that distinction on the net. So I think that whether or not people like those two words, that distinction is now evident. I'm sorry, what was this?
So why is it such a challenge to find flaws or do architecture risk analysis?
Well, it's a challenge because, you know, we've been able to automate bug finding by looking for signatures of problems or omissions of a use of some security widget or feature. And, you know, when we look for architectural flaws, there's sort of no cheating the fact that you have to understand the structure and the behavior of the software and its design.
And there's no formal description. I mean, you know, a formalized description of a system in terms of bugs and implementation is the source code. So you can pile through that, or maybe the object code. So you can pile through that looking for bugs. Much harder to pile through that looking for flaws.
Yeah, there's usually one page. And as we always, you know, we always say, hey, it's been the end of the first week of this analysis, and we built this picture of your software. You know, does this look right? And they always say, holy crap, that's better than what we have. So you're right, it very rarely is documented. And it's not documented with an eye towards the kinds of patterns and responsibilities that will have security implications. Typically, it's, I bought this widget, I shoved it in here, I bought this other widget, I connected it this way. You know,
I think it's nice when it's that. So, you know, back in the old days, you may recall when we said, hey, can we see your architecture? And they go, well, the server's here, and there's a firewall here, and here's everybody else that's the bad guy out there. And you go, no, the software architecture. And that took some, you know, a few years to get them over that hump.
It's challenging to understand. Yes, it's challenging to wring out the stacks of buzzwords or products or the network topology and come up with the level. You know, there's not a lot of computer science in certainly the breaker community, but also in development communities of the organizations that are attempting architecture analysis. And so the notion of object-oriented design patterns, they may not have been exposed to them, these individuals. And where people have been exposed to some of those more formal concepts, they haven't spent the last 10 years writing and building software and watching it break in unexpected ways, their own code, and having to fix and own those problems. And so having both the experience and that formal foundation, I think, is essential to making quick progress in architecture.
So we've always talked about ARA as a coming in three major steps, right? Step one is get yourself a list of flaws and check to see whether those flaws are in your system design.
Mm-hmm.
Step two is do a dependency analysis and see what other stuff you're counting on. And step three is the creative ambiguity analysis part. If you had those three parts, just for the sake of argument, how can you automate those? Are they equally automatable, or are some easier than others? What do you think?
So the thing we've struggled with this question for a while, both internally and externally. And one of the best things that I've found to automate is actually outside of those three. It's doing the initial diagramming. Imagine, you know, there are only so many architectures in play. There's not an infinite amount of them in practice. And so when you look at a web app, a lot of, you know, it's usually, you know, end tier, and there's usually a model view controller scheme, and there's usually a DAO and ORM on the back, and there's usually web services attached to it. These patterns end up getting plugged in almost like Legos. And there are things you can do with static analysis or with dynamic testing to identify the existence of some of those patterns in an archetype. And if you know what kind of thing you're looking at, you can start to ask some of those questions and produce the diagram a little bit automatically.
So the diagram production then drives these lists, I suppose.
Then you can start to
have some flaws associated with them that you've already piled up. some dependencies you've already taken note of.
So once you know what the thing is built out of, yeah, you can start to plug in the other kinds of knowledge that you may have, checklists or you know, other kinds of job aids. Yeah, probably the hardest thing to automate of those is what we've always referred to as ambiguity analysis. And it's funny because everyone, when we talk about that, asks about it. What are you doing? Well, we're looking for ways in which you know, designers' understanding of the system will differ from developers, or two different developers had different ideas of how components should work and interact. And everyone goes, yeah, okay, whatever, and roll their eyes. But
it's how you find new stuff.
Darned if we haven't found, you know, something critical and new every time, right, with it.
Well, my favorite thing to do when it comes to ambiguity analysis is to lock two extremely talented and experienced people in the same room with a video camera and one design and just film it.
Yeah,
and where they start fighting, that's where the interesting stuff happens. What? You thought it did this? You're crazy.
It's also unbelievable to me how long they'll argue about a particular thing as opposed to just looking at the code,
right,
and figuring out what it does.
Oh, but remember, it's not about the code. It's about possible misunderstandings or ambiguous interpretations of the design.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know,
so you're right. Ultimately, somebody has to put it into code. But even before then, you can find problems at that level before it's even coded. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigil.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. So you've already mentioned this term once, but many, probably too many, software security practitioners are pen testers or breakers. I think you called them breakers before, for lack of a better term. What about developers? What role do they have in all this?
Golly gee. So, I talked about stovepiping in terms of the assessment activities. I think there's been an over-specialization in our field in general. This notion that, and there's sort of a movement, at least in the OWASP community, to characterize builders, breakers. I think that labeling is I understand it comes from good intention, but it's sort of counterproductive. You absolutely need development skills to be a good application security guy.
So even breakers should have been builders.
We've had limited success if they're not. So yes. But I find actually from the perspective of architecture analysis, when we look at developers, they don't typically take the time to understand the underlying frameworks they're building upon well enough to do a good, forget security, design on top of it. So I'd give the developers the same advice I'd give the security guys. Dig into the code and design of the things that the software is being built and systems are being built on top of and understand it. If you don't know what the dispatcher is doing, how can you implement on Spring? If you don't know, you know, how auto wiring works, how can you...
It's supposed to be magic.
It certainly is magic.
So let's change the discourse a little bit. The term security control seems to encompass both features like username, password, and assurance activities like code review. You know,
it certainly does these days.
So what impact does such vague nomenclature have on the field?
Yeah, and I must confess, I've capitulated to this overuse and.
Well, you can't walk around in a bank on Wall Street without
using the word control to mean everything. Yes. Yeah. So I liked it better when it was framework that we were using for everything. We need a framework. So I think that is challenging. There are really important things people need to do to their architecture to improve it, to improve security. And there are really important things they need to do to the pipes, the process, to make sure the stuff going through the process is more secure. And it absolutely, when you use the word control in a bank, it typically does mean activity.
Does it? It doesn't mean feature? You sure?
Well, it does mean both.
That's the problem. See, so in my view, developers have this natural propensity to think that security is a whole bunch of features anyway, because they've been trained for years to think about features and functions and functionality. And so their slippery slope when it comes to security control is going to just be biased towards features instead of towards these assurance activities. That's what I think anyway. You have a different view?
I think both security folk and developers have that bias these days. I've always focused on making sure that people understand within the kinds of architectures they're building, the patterns and the security responsibilities those patterns have. I've often found that there's ways to either delete code or add performance and get security. And I tend to take things from that perspective as opposed to what feature do I put in one-to-one correspondence with a bug.
Mm-hmm.
I find that when I'm having conversations about controls, you have to constantly, literally visualize with your hands in the air. We're talking about these activities and these things you need to do to your architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the ambiguity in those words, you get a lot of security architects, air quotes, spending a lot of time on the process gates in their organization and not worrying about securing the design and so forth. Right?
So you're seeing a backlash towards too much emphasis on touch points or SDL activities?
I think so.
Enough on basic blocking and tackling. How'd you authenticate that guy?
Not enough on... Well,
this is interesting.
So I like input. I like input validation as an example, right? People say, well, we need an input validation control. So they visualize this widget and then they plug the widget in and they don't think about the responsibilities a client should have for validation versus the responsibilities the server should have for validation. And they're not decomposing the design problem in a high quality manner. Mm-hmm. They're just literally plugging in the control widget one-to-one with the vulnerability.
Well, see, so for me, that's an overemphasis on the feature, not an overemphasis on some sort of gate. Like if the gate were, say, architecture risk analysis there, then you would notice, gosh, maybe there are places where the client should do some of this work and the server should do some of this work and so on.
No, the way that it works when the control is visualized as an activity is they say, so we have this checklist of things you had to put in your application. Did you use the input validation library? Yep.
And that's it.
Okay, you used it in your test code, right? But that's their follow-up's never asked. And so it becomes basically a checklist.
Gotcha.
So the gate becomes a checklist and the checklist becomes a one-to-one between the vulnerability and the little widget you plugged in.
Complicated. See, so security control may not be helping us as a piece of vocabulary.
I think you and I would be in violent agreement that it is hurting us.
Right. So let's turn to static analysis. Static analysis tools are now kind of gangly adolescents being peddled by huge corporations like HP, who bought Fortify, and IBM, who bought Ounce. There are a few other players like Coverity around. What are the biggest pitfalls to watch out for when choosing or using one of these tools?
So first, choosing. There's been throughout the last 5 or so years projects to help people choose the right static analysis tool. Certainly I've been involved in a lot of selection processes. I think it's a bad idea to emphasize the selection itself, and that may sound very surprising. But to me, it's better to worry about characterizing the limitations of the tool you are going to acquire, if you're going to acquire a commercial tool, or if you're just going to adopt an open source tool. And make sure you mitigate those concerns inside of your program. That's a much better use of your time in year one than spending year one figuring out which one to buy. Because in some sense, the commercial leaders that you mentioned anyways, they both have problems, and that's okay. But if you spend the first year picking one, the one you pick is still going to, your program is still going to be glaringly limited by that problem.
To unload a term.
Right. If you had let, say, procurement get the best price on one of them, or whatever your selection criteria are, and then spent that year strengthening your initiative's use of that tool, you'd be much further along. So I'm vehemently sort of against a protracted selection process.
Okay, so let's assume that we selected the tool and built our initiative based on its limitations, as you suggested. What are the further pitfalls of, say, trying to put that tool into place in an enterprise situation?
So I break the problems down into sort of onboarding applications. You know, you've got to get applications to work in the tool, and that's typically where people get really hung up. It can take between 4 days and 2 weeks at the minimum to get each application working. If you're staring down the barrel of 300 to 1,000 apps, that's intractably long.
Right.
So you've got to work on that. You've got to figure out your solution architecture for the initiative. Is this central? Is it something you're going to do very distributed in your organization? How distributed can you make it?
In your customer pile, does that break one way or the other more often than not, or is it random?
Well, if you ask them, they would probably have strong opinions as to whether or not they're central or distributed, but all of them are very hybrid. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a lot of them, I mean, when you're talking about business units with 11,000 developers and thousands of apps, you know, it's the size of its own company. It's going to probably be different than the next business unit over.
Right.
Most people have a central program that I'm contending with, and that central program is designed for governance. Those same organizations typically provide development teams, forward-thinking development teams, something they can run in their build environment, mm-hmm. monthly, weekly, on their releases.
So they can, quote, get prepared for the gate.
So they can get prepared for the gate. And the best programs are the ones that allow those particularly forward-leaning individuals to customize the tool themselves and use basically that group as their scanning R&D, creating new rules, customizing, making the tool work better for the org.
Mm-hmm. So your factory model, now called the Enterprise Security Platform, or ESP, certainly handles this onboarding part that you were describing. That is, I've got to get the thing to build, and I have to be able to run the tool on the thing. What's the other major thing that ESP does?
Well, so there's three classes of problems, right? The onboarding you mentioned, and there's, of course, the back end problem. What comes out the rear has to be triaged, and the difficulty of that is going to be a function of how deep you want to go with your code review, in addition to what the tool does, and how accurate the tool's results are. And so it aims to help with accuracy of and organization of the results so that they're more easily triaged by someone who wants to put in manual effort.
Mm-hmm. And the third
class of problems is if you do manual things associated with your reviews, you're going to do hard work on every app and every review. And that hard work typically or historically has had to be replicated over and over again. So when you review the app next year, you have to remember that they have funny ways of including the jars or building the code or whatever. You know, they hid functions that you needed to look at. The third thing that ESP aims to do is to try to save that reviewer work, whether that be helping with the onboarding and organizing the review, pointing things out and identifying design elements and their security purpose, making the tool aware of those things in terms of rules, or pointing things out to the reviewer so that they can find things quickly the next time around.
What about frameworks?
So the static analysis or code review is kind of like, I look at code like an iceberg, and the code that you write and send to the tool is just the tip. A lot of the flow of data in your application or flow of execution is through the frameworks. And
So give an example just for people who may not know what a framework is that are listening to this.
Sure. Very simply, a very, very old and tried and true framework is the Struts sort of version 2 framework. And its job is to take URLs and figure out which class to dispatch to handle that request. So it is the controller in the model view controller architecture. And in that role, it is sort of the first thing that handles the flow of execution and the data flow in your application. And so the static analysis tool's fidelity is in a lot of senses tied to how well it can see what the frameworks are doing. Mm-hmm. And typically the frameworks are XML driven, or they're driven through inversion of control and very dynamic class loading or dynamic execution. So static analysis tools, by definition,
don't do it.
Cannot see that unless they have special widgets inside them to model that, which to date even the commercial leaders have struggled to maintain. If you look at the Java platform in particular, simply because of the multiplicity of mm-hmm. frameworks available for that platform. Mm-hmm. That's certainly something, finding where frameworks are not visualized or interpreted correctly or completely by the static analysis tools. That's certainly one of the hard pieces of work a reviewer has to do, and your static analysis initiative has to be able to account for.
And that's, take that into account, right?
And that's certainly something that ESP attempts to save and provide visibility into.
Interesting. So the last question, which is always a flyer, I'm sort of torn whether to ask you about DFW or burlesque or mixology.
Oh, geez. Is there a question that combines all three somehow?
No, I thought about it, but I didn't spend enough time when I was writing the script coming up with a triple whammy. So let's just go with mixology.
Okay.
My favorite all-time drink is called the Liberal, which is a bourbon-based beverage that has Tarania Mare and sweet vermouth, a little bit of orange bitters. What's yours, and how do you make it?
Oh, geez. So mine has to be the old-fashioned, and I guess I must specify the old fashioned. The muddled one. Yeah. Yes, and so you know I'm a big fan of brandying the cherry.
I still have some of your brandied cherries in my fridge.
Well, you said they were too autumnal, so it's coming up on time for them.
That's right.
That's also a bourbon based drink, rye. Uh-huh.
So explain how you make this thing real quick.
Oh golly gee! So I take 2 ounces of Old Overholt rye, which has the advantage of being $8 a bottle. And in my opinion, better than most, an order of magnitude more expensive than it. Then I put a dash of Angostura bitters in it, dash of Fees Brothers whiskey barrel bitters in it. And then I make my own simple syrup. So I put a dash of that in and a dash of club soda. Mm-hmm.
Slice of orange?
From there, yes, this is where you get into arguments, on how old you want your old fashioned. And I must confess, I go anywhere from the twist of lime to the flag, to the brandy cherry, to the. So.
Okay, well, we'll leave it up to the listeners to figure this all out. Thanks very much for your time.
It's worth experimenting with. That's the key.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Inform IT. The September-October issue of IEEE S&P is a special issue on cyber war. The interview department features our chat with CBS reporter Eleanor Mills. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.